West Pakistan, and ever since independence in 1947, treated the east part of its country as a colonial fiefdom, and milked it of whatever agricultural surplus it produced, jute and tea, had ruthlessly suppressed any nationalist ambitions by the Bengali majority. When, during recent elections, this nationalist sentiment had coalesced behind the Awami Party of Sheikh Mujib Rahman, its army had set about ruthlessly to suppress the movement, to undo the elections. India, which had fought two wars with Pakistan since 1947, saw in the presence on its soil of those who had fled from Pakistani suppression a chance to turn a dirty trick against its enemy. And it armed the more militant and belligerent of them and trained them in guerrilla and commando warfare. It sent them back into East Pakistan, and by November of this year, organized groups of the Indian Army had crossed the border and were operating within East Pakistan itself. Now, India is one of the signatures of the Charter of the United Nations, which itself is not a momentous fact. All the countries of the world are signatories, practically all are signatories of that charter. But India has, in the last 20 years or so, made itself into the preacher and apostle of the United Nations. It has taken to preaching to the world about the sins of the rest of the world, and espousing in a positive way the policies of non-alignment, non-violence, peaceful solutions to international problems, and the use of existing international machinery. Now, Article 2 of the Charter of the United Nations requires the settlement of disputes between nations by peaceful means, and adds that member states must refrain from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity and political independence of any state. India, in the last months of 1971, violated every term of this second article of the Charter of the United Nations. Mrs. Gandhi, at the conclusion of what was obviously a very successful military engagement, told a cheering Congress in New Delhi, and I quote, "If India had allowed a nation to be stifled and a people to be suppressed, it would have been a disgrace to us. If a country does not raise its voice against injustice elsewhere, it cannot fight injustice at home." Now, the delegates to the Indian Congress applauded loudly these high moral sentiments. But an American who had heard presidents use practically the same words over the last 15 years to make us appreciate the morality of our involvement in Vietnam, to an American, these words had something of a hollow ring. For had we too not involved ourselves in another country which to prevent its people from being stifled, its independence from being suppressed? Had President Kennedy and then President Johnson not told us that if we were not concerned with freedom and injustice abroad, we would ultimately not be able to handle the problems of freedom and injustice at home? But obviously, success is one of the determinators of the moral quality of an action. And in terms of military strategy, India's involvement in East Pakistan had been an unmitigated success. She'd been able to reduce the territory of her nearest enemy, Pakistan, by some 50,000 square miles. She had cut her population by more than half, from 130 million to 55 million. She had reduced Pakistan's rather modest gross national product from some 18 billions of dollars to 12 billions of dollars. And she had done so in a contest which was really no contest from the beginning. Her generals, you'll recall, treated the action as a good show, as an exercise in military tactics, a classic kind of exercise which had been presented to them at the military college. For India had nothing to lose. East Pakistan was separated from West Pakistan by well over 1,000 miles. And the Indian Air Force, which outnumbered almost 2-1 the Pakistani Air Force, and in firepower and in the modernity and speed of its aircraft by a far greater ratio, controlled the air route. And in effect, her navy, much larger than the Pakistani navy, controlled the very long, slow sea route by which alone the Pakistani army could be supplied and reinforced. India had 850,000 men under arms. The Pakistanis had only 250,000, of whom only some 80,000 were in the East. And more than this, India had a friend in court, the most aggressive, the most energetic superpower in the world today, the Soviet Union. A government which since 1954 had been supplying India with ever more effective and more modern weapons of war. A government which had signed with India in August of this year a 20-year friendship and cooperation treaty, which had guaranteed not only close commercial and military relationships between the two countries, but which in effect guaranteed that they would dovetail their international activities, so much so that India was confident that until Dhaka had fallen, until this military exercise was completed, she had nothing to fear at the Security Council of the United Nations that the world would demand a ceasefire, a standstill, some kind of ultimate withdrawal of troops. That in effect she could accomplish her military objectives and be guaranteed that the international community concerned with the integrity of nations, of boundaries, would not be able to utter a word, an effective word, and put nothing on record. Why? Because the Soviet Union had a veto, and the Soviet Union was prepared to exercise the veto, and the Soviet Union did, in fact, twice exercise that veto. Pakistan was guilty of colonialism, suppression, tyranny. India was guilty of the naked, selfish use of force, and of hypocrisy. The Soviet Union was guilty of her traditional policy of quite calculating and callous realpolitik, a lack of concern for any value save the values which make for victory, for success. And the United States was guilty of not being able to accept gracefully her decision to pull back her commitments, to withdraw from certain areas of the world, to recognize that having been, in a sense, shackled by the tragedy of Vietnam, having decided because of economic needs, because of defeat abroad, that she could no longer involve herself in widespread commitments, that she was unable to exercise any kind of significant force in the solution of problems beyond the perimeters which our State Department administration seemed to have drawn. And so we had the rather sad sight in Washington of diplomats squabbling with one another and releasing information to privileged information to the media in order to beg off, to say in a sense, the administration is guilty, not the State Department, or the State Department is guilty, not the administration. We were still in the pose as if we could champion all good causes in the world and had not recognized that our decision to turn in on ourselves and to withdraw was of necessity the decision, that many things would happen in the world of which we did not approve, but which we, in fact, could not affect. It was the direction of change which we could not determine. I tried hard as I analyzed the events of the last several months in South Asia to find a ray of light, find some one element in the whole unfortunate political interchange, the war, which might be hopeful. Perhaps I thought the emergence of a Bengali nation, of Bangladesh, this is nationalism at its best, perhaps. Here is an opportunity under Sheikh Rahman for a new group to assert themselves, a people which has a long and proud history. Perhaps this will be a force for progress and for peace. And yet I kept wondering to myself what the Sheikh would inherit in his new nation. He would inherit the seventh most populous nation in the world, a nation whose density of population is the greatest in the world, and increasing by some 3.4% every year. He would inherit a nation whose average income is $1 a week. He would inherit a nation whose two major agricultural exports, jute and tea, are exports whose value is falling on the international market. He would inherit a nation which has a 92% rate of illiteracy. He would inherit a nation which has no claim on any superpower for foreign aid, for the kinds of massive investment of capital which might permit the damming of the great rivers which periodically during the monsoon season overflow and destroy so much of that land. He would inherit the most suffering nation on earth. And he would lack, obviously, the means of effectively coping with the vast array of economic and social problems which face Bangladesh. And strangely, perhaps the only policy which offers him any chance of unifying Bangladesh would be to turn the frustrations and the suffering of the people towards nationalism, which meant towards a policy of reunification with the rest of the Bengali nation, just to the west in India. There are more Bengalis than there are in all of Bangladesh. Calcutta is the natural capital of a Bengali nation. Paradoxically, all the Indians may have won out of this war in the long run is a continuing problem of unrest within their own Bengal state, a state which is the poorest in all of India, whose capital, Calcutta, once a gracious city, is today the hellhole of misery in our universe, where 500,000 people go to sleep every night on the sidewalks, where there is open violence, where there is such chaos and disorder that Mrs. Gandhi has already deposed the communist governor of Bengal and rules Bengal tyrannically from New Delhi without any concern for its local or state rights, because she cannot allow the country, this province, to fall further into disorder. What then shall we say about this miserable tragedy? Perhaps the only thing that comes out of it of a positive nature is this. It ought for once and for all to have taken the blinders from the eyes of those in the West who believe that all teaching and all truth will come from the third world, from the non-aligned. At the end of the Second World War and during the days of the Cold War, many in the West became disabused and disillusioned about their own governments. They came to recognize what we call the credibility gap, the hypocrisy between pronouncement and action. Our children were taught, as we had been taught, about the colonial and imperial ambitions of the powers of Europe, and now suddenly we had to say, we too have such ambitions. We too have used and abused the poor and the backward of the world. And at about this time, as the colonial powers emerged into independence, they began with all of the moral authority of the abused to speak of their own rights, to speak with the voice of the poor, of peaceful solutions, international problems, of a new era where the people would dominate, of the importance of the have-nots to give moral balance to the world. Mr. Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India after independence, tried to create at Bandung in the early 1950s and other international conferences, a great coalition of the non-aligned, of the third world. And he tried to give it a moral force so that it would say to the world, this is what must be done. We represent the majority of the population of the world, though not the center of the world's power. Listen to us. Listen to the voice of humanity. We speak for peace, we speak for economic justice, we speak for the new freedom. Listen to us and to our voice. This is what we need. We need for the great powers to curb their appetites, to be responsive to what we say, to limit their power through international undertakings. And it sounded impressive, and the West was filled with guilt. Mr. Nehru was able to win for India, in part because he inherited the great moral presence of Mahatma, the great soul, Mohandas Gandhi. It created for India a presence in the world which allowed its diplomats to go from platform to platform, from college to college, preaching nonviolence, preaching truth force, preaching the importance of going beyond the state, going beyond a policy of peace through terror, through balance of power, talking of the United Nations, of world government, of world law, of the sharing of wealth equally between the powers of the world. And many were impressed, for there was a great deal of truth if one listened carefully. But then the nations, the so-called non-aligned nations, began to prove that they were nations just like all others. Do you remember the little community of Goa? Goa is a little city-state which was ruled by Portugal for some 400 years on the west coast of India. In the late 1950s, Prime Minister Nehru decided that Goa had to go. And he tried to pressure Portugal into withdrawing its troops, as England had withdrawn from the rest of India. And Portugal responded, run by a dictator, Salazar, responded by saying that Goa was considered by Portugal to be part of the homeland. It wasn't a colony at all. What did Nehru do? He marched in the Indian troops, and he conquered Goa. And when Portugal threatened to bring up India for a violation of territory, for occupation of territory, at the United Nations, Mr. Nehru announced to the world that this was a matter of internal policy, that the United Nations wasn't at all involved in the issue, and that whatever the United Nations did, India had done what needed to be done, and that was the beginning and the end of it. Then in northern India, there's the great, beautiful province of Kashmir. It was decided in 1947, during the partition of India, that the Kashmir question was to be left in abeyance. Kashmir was claimed by India, and was claimed by Pakistan, and was also claimed by its own natives, the Kashmiri, as an independent force. And so there was an agreement between the parties, England, India, and Pakistan, that in time there would be a plebiscite in Kashmir, and that the plebiscite would determine its future. India, at the end of the 1947, fighting with Pakistan, controlled most of Kashmir. And India set about undoing the necessity of such a plebiscite, denying that one would or could ever take place. And when questions were asked by governments and in the United Nations, when will this plebiscite take place? More and more, the government of Mr. Nehru answered, the Kashmiri question is an internal Indian question and of no concern to the world community. And when Sheikh Abdullah, the leader of Kashmiri nationalism, began to demand on his own the plebiscite so that his people might express themselves, India responded by throwing the Sheikh into jail, where he languished until he was prepared to recant and to put an end to his particular nationalist ambitions. More and more, the countries of this non-aligned third world began to show that they were as imperialistic-minded, that they were as annexionist-minded, that they were as militaristic, unfortunately, as the rest of the world. And a strange thing happened on the way to the third world, and that is that it became not a moral force, but a purely realpolitik, political force. The axis was Mr. Tito in Yugoslavia, Mr. Nasser in Egypt, and Mr. Nehru in India. And instead of speaking now in terms of peace and non-alignment, they developed a third world party line, a line which was increasingly under the impress of the Soviet Union. As the Soviet Union began the massive sending of armaments to two of the three major parties in the third world, Mr. Nasser and Mr. Nehru. And this party line expressed itself in many ways. When the United States went into Vietnam, Indian diplomats through the world were very quick to talk about troops being sent so many thousands of miles from home, about the rights of the Indian South Asian people to make up their own mind, about the importance of nationalism. When Soviet troops went into Czechoslovakia, the Indian delegate at the United Nations abstained on every resolution that was introduced, condemning the Soviet intrusion into Czechoslovakian affairs. When one wants to trace the politicization, the selfish politicization of Indian policies and third world policies, there's interestingly no better example than that of the relationships of India and Israel. Imagine, Israel becomes a litmus paper not only for governments in the West, the United States, Soviet Union, but even for the government of India. India is largely a Hindu nation. One cannot speak of India as part of the Arab world that caught up in this whole poison of jihad, of a holy war, of a holy crusade against a Jewish state. In 1947 and 48, when the United Nations announced the creation of Israel and passed the partition resolution, India at the beginning was willing to recognize de facto and then later de jure the existence of Israel, was willing to allow the Israelis to open up a consulate in New Delhi, but was never willing to send an ambassador to Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. They pulled back. They were a little shy. There were a number of Muslims high in the Congress party, and the Indian government said, we don't want to offend everyone. Well and good. There were some trade relations between India and Israel. There were some missions where Indians went to Israel and were trained in agriculture and science by the various Israeli institutions. But then, as Mr. Nehru became more imperial-minded, as Indian policy moved on into its new stage, what began as a policy of caution became a policy of active sponsorship of the Arab cause. In 1956 and 1957, during the Suez Campaign, the voice of India was raised again and again against England and France and Israel for their actions, demanding the immediate withdrawal of Israel from the Sinai. The Indian delegate of the United Nations said he could not see why the Egyptians had to grant Israelis the right of free passage through the Suez Canal. India was part of the peacekeeping force that the United Nations sent into Gaza and into the Sinai after the 56th Suez campaign. And in 1967, in May, when General Nasser demanded the withdrawal of that force, the Indians were the first to say their contingents would be withdrawn. And the Israelis have reason to believe that when the Indians withdrew, they left behind their positions and their maps and their information to the Egyptians. And at the United Nations, after the 67 war, when the Russians were sponsoring a resolution demanding the immediate withdrawal of Israel, unilateral withdrawal, compensation and reparations for war damages, no talk of peace, no talk of bracketing the needs of recognition of sovereignty with all of these acts. The Indian government was one of the staunchest allies of this whole program, and the Indian diplomat at the United Nations got up and he said that his government not only did not understand by what right Israel could claim freedom of passage through the Suez Canal, but she failed to recognize by what right the Israeli government claimed freedom of passage through the Gulf of Aqaba and into the sea. During the long summer and early fall of 1967, as the United Nations were trying to work out some kind of more even-handed arrangement, the Indian delegation put in, along with Niger and Mali, a resolution which was one-sided and simply attacked Israel, demanded withdrawal and reparations, and made no demands for the recognition of Israel's existence by her neighbors. Early in 1968, this policy began to escalate. Israelis began to recognize that fewer and fewer Indians were allowed to come to Israel to attend various seminars. In July of 1968, in August, when you remember the Al-Aqsa Mosque was burnt by an Australian fundamentalist by the name of Rohan, the Indians began to shout loudly that Israel was using this man as a cover-up for what had been an act of ugliness and violence against the sacred shrines of Islam. And when the Muslims, the Arabs, convened at Rabat in Morocco, a high-level conference to determine how jihad, how the holy war was to be reorganized against Israel, now this act of violence had been performed, India, a Hindu nation, asked for the right of representation at that conference, sent delegates to that conference, and was refused admission only because the Pakistani delegate said that he would not sit in the same room with the Indian delegate. And as the Indian delegate went home, he said, "We understand the inter-Muslim pressures and that you did not want to accede to Pakistan but had to, and we want you to know that we are with you in every way, though we cannot be with you physically." And when the Indian press began to challenge this obvious act of contempt for the Indian presence by the Arab states, a man by the name of Desai Singh, who was the foreign minister of India at the time, responded by attending the opening of the permanent offices of the El Fatah in New Delhi and promising the cooperation of his ministry and of the government with the activities of the El Fatah in the liberation of the Palestinian peoples. Even-handedness, concern for peace, concern for international machinery, all this had gone by the wayside as Mr. Nehru had ruled, and Mr. Shastri, and now Mrs. Gandhi. More and more, they have found themselves in the Russian orbit, obliged to the Russians for arms and commercial credits, eager to please the Russians by taking positions which will be in their interest. More and more, they have found themselves eager to belong to the Arab world, even though they're fighting a so-called Muslim nation. More and more, they have tried to involve themselves in a battle which they cannot have an immediate political or economic interest. More and more, India has shown herself to be concerned with the communist minorities within her own nation, which are sizable, which are effectively the majority in East Bengal, in Bengal, in Calcutta,
and in Kerala and elsewhere in the continent. More and more, Mrs. Gandhi has taken her nation down a road of active, violent opposition to the existence of the State of Israel. Interestingly, in 1967, the resolution which the Indian delegates submitted to the United Nations requiring Israel, which would have required Israel to withdraw unilaterally to make restitution and so on, included this phrase: "The occupation or acquisition of territory by military conquest is inadmissible under the Charter of the United Nations." The occupation or acquisition of territory by military conquest is inadmissible under the Charter of the United Nations. Now, if India's activities in Bangladesh do not fall into the meaning of that sentence, I do not know what meaning this sentence can possibly have. The Third World, it seems to me, has been, unfortunately, discredited as a moral force. It speaks now for specific political, narrow political ambitions and undertakings of the various powers and power groups involved. And as I reviewed this sad history, my mind found itself again and again drawn to that remarkable little aesthetic, Mohandas Gandhi, the man whose force of will and presence of mind and whose policy of satyagraha, truth force, in a sense gave India her freedom. I wondered what Gandhi would say to Mrs. Gandhi, who incidentally is no relative of his. She's the daughter of Mr. Nehru. I wonder what he would have said to Mrs. Gandhi as he watched India resort to arms in order to complete the conquest of East Pakistan, to resort to hypocrisy in order to justify that undertaking. Mr. Gandhi had never believed in arms. He believed that those who resorted to force destroyed themselves, if not physically, spiritually. That only people who were prepared to live with the dignity of suffering, only such a people had really the right to be free. In 1919, the government of Great Britain passed what was called the Rowlatt Act. The Rowlatt Act was a series of repressive measures designed to reduce the level of terrorism which Indians had begun to undertake against the Raj, against the imperial rule of Great Britain. And the Rowlatt Act said, in effect, that a terrorist or a suspected terrorist might be imprisoned and sentenced without due process and without trial, simply by executive order. Gandhi had just returned to India from his activities in South Africa, and he began to organize what was to be the first Hartal, the first nationwide strike of the Indian peoples against their British overlords. It was to be non-violent. The Indians would simply not go to work. They would sit in peaceful protest with their composure and their dignity and their protest being a nationwide reproach to a government which ruled them with such abuse. And from Bombay, where he was then living, Gandhi proclaimed late that on the 30th of March of 1920, this first Hartal, this first nationwide peaceful strike, was to take place. The constabulary run by the British resorted to mass arrests and to use of force, and the Indians resorted to force in return. There were riots in many cities. And Gandhi's response was not to say, look, we've accomplished our ends, let's stay on with this Hartal day after day until we've brought England to its knees. She can't operate India without us. His response to the violence of his own people was to call off the Hartal, to call it off against the will of the politicians within the Congress party. He said, we're accomplishing our ends. And he said, no, we're not. We're unleashing violence the worst in the Indian character. We have a job to do. We first have to discipline ourselves. We first have to find peace and the capacity to suffer in ourselves before we can launch a policy of freedom. Because if we bring India to freedom, and the freedom is simply the freedom of a chaotic people, of an undisciplined people, that will not be freedom at all. And for the next 10 years, before the next great Hartle was pronounced, was called, Gandhi dedicated himself to teaching the Indian people what it meant to have moral self-discipline. He lived in an ashram, in a kind of Indian monastery. By penance, by meditation, by observing a day of silence every week, by the study of the ancient scriptures, by a life of dignity and of simplicity, as he shed the values of the West and tried to find the native values of India, Gandhi gave an example to his people of the kind of moral self-control that a free people must have if they are truly to be free. And from beginning to end, his life was dedicated to this kind of peace. One must not only throw the oppressor out, but one must throw the capacity for oppression, which is in every man's soul, out. One must burn it out from within. Otherwise, one achievement of freedom is illusory, because we simply replace one overlord, one set of the privileged, with another. At the very end of his life, Gandhi was still fighting for this very same principle. This was in 1947. 46 and 47. Independence was approaching. There were raging battles in many of the cities between the Muslim and the Hindus, religious wars. And Gandhi went around northern India particularly, trying to bring peace where his own people were waging war. He didn't believe in partition. He believed that the Muslim and the Hindu all were Indian, all could live together if only they could control themselves, that the real enemy was not in London, but the real enemy was in the human soul. This was the enemy that India would have to learn to control. Early in his life, he wrote a book called Hind Swaraj, The Liberation of India. It's a fascinating book, which I went back to this last week, in which he tries to set out his philosophy of what liberation can truly mean and how it must be truly won. And he said in this book, he's arguing with his fellow Indians who are demanding terrorism, guerrilla war, and the like. Again, you say that India can fight only when she has arms. You have not considered this problem at all. The English are splendidly armed. That does not frighten me. But it is clear that to pit ourselves against them in arms, thousands of Indians must be armed. If such a thing be possible, how many years will it take? Moreover, to arm India on a large scale is to Europeanize it. Then her condition will be just as pitiable as that of Europe. This means, in short, that India must accept European civilization. And if that is what we want, the best thing is that we have among us those who are so well trained in European civilization. We will then fight for a few rights, we'll get what we can, and so pass our days. But the fact is that the Indian nation will not adopt arms, and it is well that it does not. If India was to adopt the way of war, the way of arming, the way of guerrilla tactics in that era, she would Europeanize herself, become another jackal nation among all the jackal nations of the world. And Gandhi's prophecy has proved true. And that's the sad meaning of the events of the last months. India has become another nation of power, ambition, of tanks and planes and missiles among all the other nations of the world. And that somehow the voice, the spirit of effective peacemaking, which is represented by Mahatma, the great soul, has passed out of India, and that the Indian cannot demand a certain credence for his words on the international platforms, which other diplomats do not instinctively get. 2 weeks before Desai Singh, the foreign minister of India, attended the dedication of what is effectively the consulate of the El Fatah, New Delhi, and pledged his cooperation and his interest. He had been making a tour of colleges and churches in the United States, teaching the way of Gandhi, teaching the way of satyagraha, truth force, what we call nonviolent or passive resistance. Well, that, dear friends, is hypocrisy, whether it be done by a diplomat in New Delhi or a diplomat in Washington. I pray that in the days ahead, India will recognize that she has Europeanized herself, and that Gandhi taught her a great truth when he said, to thine own self be true, remain true to the spirit of peace which can be expressed by the best within our own tradition. But this much is true. Whatever configuration or form our world will take, the form which it has now, is one in which the great powers of the world speak of peace, but do not really mean what they say. For their interests are strategic and tactical, and go to their own advantage. And we must add now India to that long and unfortunate list. Amen.